Our fifth case for today is Jones v. Zatecky. Mr. Butaro?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Andrew Butaro, and I am here today on behalf of David Michael Jones, the petitioner appellant in this case. We're here today because David Jones was deprived of a Sixth Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel. That deprivation occurred when his trial attorneys failed to object to a criminal confinement charge that was untimely under then-existing Indiana law. As a result of that failure to object, Jones was sentenced to additional decades in prison. Under the Strickland standard, an attorney is constitutionally ineffective if there is deficient performance and if that deficient performance causes prejudice. Today, I would like to talk about just two specific issues. First, I would like to explain why, under Strickland, there was prejudice from the non-objection, both at the trial court and on appeal. Second, and time permitting, I'd like to discuss the appropriate relief in this case. Strickland's prejudice prong requires us to consider whether there is a reasonable probability that, but for counsel's errors, the outcome of the proceeding would have been different. So let's walk through what could have happened.
Well, and a reasonable probability, of course, is not defined as a preponderance. It's defined as enough to cause one not to have confidence in the outcome.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. In the 1984 Strickland decision, the Supreme Court expressly declined to adopt a more likely than not standard and defined a reasonable probability as a probability that is sufficient to undermine confidence in the outcome. And that's exactly what happened here.
So can you see any material distinctions between this case and Shaw against Wilson?
Your Honor, I see one distinction here, and in fact, I think it cuts in favor of Jones. The distinction is that in Shaw, we were discussing ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. Here, of course, we're talking about ineffective assistance of trial counsel. So the question in Shaw was whether making one argument, in that case, an insufficiency of the evidence argument, was materially stronger than making the timeliness of the amendment argument. Here, the analysis is even more straightforward, because what we have to ask is, was it materially stronger for Jones's trial attorneys to have objected versus making no objection at all? So rather than weighing the merits of two arguments, we're really talking about whether it was stronger to make an argument versus no argument at all. And
at the time of this trial, Hock, at least, has been decided by the Indiana Supreme Court. So you don't have to be a genius lawyer to think of this argument.
Absolutely. You had two very strong sources of authority here. You had, first and foremost, the statute, Indiana Code, Section 3534.15, that governs the timeliness of amendments. And then that's a 1982 statute. And then you have the 1998 Hawk decision, in which the Indiana Supreme Court, to quote Shaw, unequivocally held that the statute essentially means what it says. And I think that's why in 2013 this court said in Shaw that this would have been an obvious argument to counsel at the time. And the same statute applied for Troy Shaw's proceeding as applied for David Jones's proceeding. And so,
what if at the time of Mr. Jones's trial, the lower courts had been ignoring or distinguishing Hock for decades and allowing untimely amendments?
Well, Your Honor,
would it still be your view that his counsel were required to object to the timeliness of the new charge?
Absolutely, Your Honor, for a few reasons. First of all, we can see that there was some confusion on this point in the Indiana appellate courts. I want to reiterate that the 1998 Hawk decision from the Indiana Supreme Court was never disturbed. But there was some inconsistent application among the Indiana appellate courts. So why then is there a duty to make this argument? I come back to the sheer scope of the sentence. I mean, we are talking in this case about a criminal confinement charge that carried the most significant sentencing implications for David Jones, 20 years. And that's even before we get into the habitual offender adjudication, which, of course, is calculated based off an underlying felony, which added even additional time. So I think that a trial attorney should have been aware that just because the sentence was so significant, there was a duty to investigate and attack this in any way he could.
Well, at the trial level, I believe in Indiana, there was at least this process of setting an omnibus date, right? So counsel should have known that something was happening.
That's correct. The omnibus date was a longstanding feature of Indiana law. This statute in particular went back to 1982. There were predecessor statutes in Indiana that governed this issue. In fact, in this case, unlike Shaw, we have post-conviction testimony from two of Jones's attorneys. And they expressed an awareness of the omnibus date. But somewhat curiously, they didn't articulate any reason why, in light of that, they wouldn't have objected. They didn't say that there was no strategic reason. They said, well, we can't remember.
They basically say they have no recollection at all of this case. It's one of many that floated by.
That's exactly right. And I think again, in light of the fact that this was such a significant charge, and that other motions to dismiss were filed in this case, which is another curious feature. I mean, there were attempts to dismiss elements of the intimidation charge and a subsequent amendment to the criminal confinement charge that was held to be an amendment of form. It's almost like they just missed the most obvious and most significant argument, frankly. And the problem with this is that there was prejudice at the trial court because you had those two sources of authority. You had the statute. You had the Hawk decision. And you also had evidence that trial courts were actually rejecting late amendments. So I do think that the state overstates the situation a bit when they describe this in briefing as doomed. And we know this because...
Well, it certainly wasn't doomed, because when it gets taken up to the Indiana Supreme Court in Fajardo, the Indiana Supreme Court reaffirms Hawk.
That's exactly it. And if we even want to go to the pre-Fajardo world, we can look at Davenport and we can look at Klein, which are cited at page 917 of the Shaw opinion by this court, and they show that in at least some instances, trial courts were rejecting untimely amendments. The problem is we have a bit of a dog that doesn't bark problem, in a sense, because the appellate decisions are only showing situations where the state added an untimely charge or attempted to and it went up on appeal. We don't have situations where the trial court rejected that and that was the end of it. And we also, to make a broader point, since there's sort of this broader picture of the statute being ignored, there's also the broader point that there are probably many instances in which the state said, well, we just can't add a charge because it's barred by the statute.
They were complying with the statute?
Exactly right. I'll give the state some credit on that point. So you had a situation where you had this authority. There was more than a fighting chance, to borrow Shaw's phrase, that it could have succeeded. And the problem is that this failure to object was compounded on appellate review. Because Jones essentially could have had three bites at the apple here. You could have prevailed at the trial court. You might have prevailed on direct appeal. In his direct appeal in this case, the court said, well, we can't consider the timeliness issue because it was waived. Well, what makes that troubling, especially in this case, is that his direct appeal was decided on November 8th, 2007. On October 23rd, 2007, 15 days before, the Fuller versus Indiana decision came down. We talk about this on page 32 of our opening brief.
Fajardo, yeah.
Actually, the Fuller decision.
Oh, Fuller?
That's correct. This is an Indiana appeals court decision that actually applied Fajardo.
That applies Fajardo.
And said, in light of Fajardo, we're going to vacate a charge that was added by untimely amendment.
So if it hadn't been waived, maybe.
Exactly right. You have a 15-day separation, the same issue, and you have an Indiana appellate panel ruling post-Fajardo that the amendment was untimely and should be vacated. And then, of course, even if he lost on direct appeal, there's a chance that he might have prevailed on transfer to the Indiana Supreme Court, as the January 2007 Fajardo decision shows that the Indiana Supreme Court was interested in resolving this very issue.
Okay. If you'd like to save a second, that's fine.
Sure. I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Loy?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Clearly established decisional law of the Supreme Court does not require trial counsel to make an objection that has no support in the law, has no reasonable likelihood of success, or is an anticipation that the state of the law will change.
That's here, all true, but that is not this case, because the Indiana Supreme Court in 1998, long before this case, had said that 35-34-15 means what it says. And so counsel didn't have to imagine that Fajardo was going to come along. Hawk, as we pointed out in Shaw, was already there. And indeed, for a Strickland claim, as we also pointed out in Shaw, you don't have to show you would have won. You just have to show that competent counsel would have raised a particular point under state law, a point that would have been a very powerful argument to make for the defendant. So I agree with your opening statement, but I just don't think it fits this situation at all.
Your Honor, if I may address a couple of points. One is that Hawk was not understood by Indiana appellate courts or the Supreme Court itself to be a change in the law. In fact, it was Fajardo that did that. And Fajardo went through the history of the over two decades of Indiana decisional law, which...
But wait a minute. But in Hawk, the Indiana Supreme Court says untimely amendments are impermissible if they're amendments of substance. And there are various other things prosecutors can do for amendments of form. And you have the statutory language. Now, of course, the lawyers in some of these other cases did spot this issue. And I think Mr. Buttaro makes a good point. For those instances in which prosecutors were actually complying with 353415, the omnibus state is being respected. Amendments of substance are made outside that 30-day window. No litigation ensues. We don't have the case. So particularly since we're just trying to figure out, was trial counsel ineffective in performance? I think prejudice is pretty easy, but in performance to fail to try to make this point when we know from Indiana that it was already established by the Indiana Supreme Court. It's in the statute, and then is later reaffirmed by the Indiana Supreme Court. It's hard for me to see how this case differs from Shaw.
Your Honor, Fajardo did not reaffirm any holding in Hawk. And in fact, Hawk simply has a paragraph in dicta that says proper considerations in applying the relevant statute, and it quotes the statute and says, thus, if the amendment was of substance or prejudicial to the defendant, even if of form, it was impermissible under the statute. But
so
Hawk
honestly,
didn't address
wouldn't
that
a
issue.
Competent lawyer, do lawyers in Indiana just ignore things that the Indiana Supreme Court writes?
No, and in
Surely
fact,
not.
A reasonable, competent attorney in this situation would look at over two decades of Indiana decisional law that allowed substantive amendments if it did not prejudice the substantial rights of the defendant.
In the
and second
face
of all, the two
of
cases.
This paragraph from the Indiana Supreme Court, a lawyer wouldn't say this is worth a shot?
Yes, Your Honor. And this court cannot second guess the state of the law, which Indiana has said repeatedly.
I am not second
guessing. Was not before Fajardo. And as recently in the remand after this court granted conditional habeas relief in Shaw. Second of all, the two cases, the Davenport and Klein, was not based solely on the timeliness of the amendment, but instead looked at the prejudice. One was done 3 weeks before trial. The other amendment was done 4 days before trial. And so the idea that timeliness had been somehow divorced from an understanding of prejudice belies what actually occurred in Davenport and Klein, which this court identified in Shaw. In addition, excuse me, Your Honor. Yes, there were other motions filed to challenge subsequent amendments in this case, and I think, in fact, that supports
no,
what
the... No, it
doesn't.
It just shows that the lawyer totally blew it by not giving it a try on this motion.
It demonstrates that those motions were made in lockstep with what the Indiana decisional law was at the time.
Was there any downside for Jones or his trial counsel in making a timeliness objection to the amendment? Was there any downside?
There was no downside, but that is not the standard by which we apply Strickland. The double deference that we apply in Strickland on habeas review, which is whether the Indiana courts unreasonably applied Strickland, which in this case it did not. Yes, a lawyer misses 100% of the shots the lawyer doesn't take. But that is not the requirement of Strickland, nor is it unreasonable for a state court not to require that of trial counsel. The analysis of trial counsel is different from that of Shaw.
If Hawk had never been decided, and you had a long line of Indiana appellate court cases construing, you know, Indiana doesn't usually say that the language of the statute doesn't make any difference, but let's assume that Indiana has decided not to bother with the language of the statute here. So you have all these appellate cases saying, well, yes, you know, there's this omnibus state and there's a 30-day time rule, but there isn't really a 30-day time rule. People get criticized for doing that, you know, in the federal courts, but maybe Indiana's different. You would have a different case, but we have Hawk, we have the language of the statute.
We have dicta in Hawk. The holding in Hawk had nothing to do with that particular dicta.
It's a Supreme Court. This court tries to pay attention to the U.S. Supreme Court's dicta.
Hawk doesn't address at all the other provisions in the statute itself, which allow amendments that are not prejudiced to the substantial rights.
That are amendments of form.
It talks about defects.
This was not an amendment of form.
The amendment also talks about
omissions. You're not saying this was an amendment of form.
I'm sorry?
You're not saying this was an amendment of form.
Your Honor, I don't believe that is necessary to decide in this
case. But I just want to be clear. You're not claiming that this was a form.
I think there is an argument that this is a form. The criminal confinement was part and parcel of the event that included the battery. The confinement was limited to the dragging of the victim while she was unconscious from one area outside of that main living area into the house. That was part and parcel.
Is there a different penalty associated with criminal confinement from the original battery?
The criminal confinement is an elevated level of felony,
so it's
a B felony rather than a C
form,
felony.
Don't you think?
I'm sorry?
Hard to say that's form.
Well, I think that it also, if we look to the history of the Indiana state law, looking at what is of substance and what is of form, it does not divorce what is of substance from whether the defendant is prejudiced or not. And in fact, if we look at the statute, paragraph D refers to if an indictment or information is amended, then there should be a motion made by the defendant that it would prejudice the defendant that the trial court should consider continuing the trial so that the defendant is not prejudiced.
But that applies to form amendments.
I disagree.
Doesn't apply to the substance. That's what I'm not the Indiana Supreme Court, but that's what they said.
In Fajardo, not in Hawk.
And in Hawk, although you don't like Hawk because you say it was all dicta.
No, Hawk never addresses subsection D, which is what the Indiana Court of Appeals had addressed after Hawk, in noting Hawk's dicta, but noting that Hawk did not address in its holding what was relevant as of amendments of substance after the omnibus state.
But they do comment in Hawk that other procedures are available. They don't go into any detail to make post-omnibus amendments, but they apply only to form amendments. They do comment on that.
No, Your Honor, they only reference subsection A and subsection
C. Well, I know they don't
C.
cite it. I'm agreeing with you on the citation, but they comment.
And a comment is not enough to challenge the over two decades.
So is this
Indiana
the way you practice
law?
I mean, do lawyers in Indiana really not make motions because they think a signal from the Indiana Supreme Court can be disregarded?
I think Indiana attorneys make reasonable professional judgments in light of the body of state law. And in this case, the challenges to the amendments were made in lockstep with what the Indiana decisional law was at the time, which was looking at whether or not the defendant was prejudiced. And Jones has never made an argument that he was prejudiced by the amendments. So trial counsel in this case acted with reasonable professional judgment. I think to say otherwise would be to impermissibly view trial counsel's performance at the time in the lens of hindsight and to second-guess the state of the Indiana state law that Indiana has said multiple times since Fajardo.
Okay.
If there are no further questions, Your Honor. All right. We ask that you affirm the district court.
Thank you very much. Mr. Buttaro, anything further?
Just a few very brief points in rebuttal, Your Honor. First of all, on the question of whether the comment in Hawk was dicta or holding, this court has already decided that issue. On page 911 of the 2013 Shaw decision, it described it as an unequivocal holding. I think that's exactly correct, and there's no need to revisit that issue. Second, the test in Indiana for whether an amendment is one of substance or form is whether it is essential to the valid making of a crime. Of course, the criminal confinement charge was essential to making the criminal confinement charge. So I think it's pretty clear we're talking about an amendment of substance here. And just to revisit Judge Rovner's question about the downside versus upside dynamic here, I think that's exactly the issue. Just like in the First Circuit decision, Prue, that decided in briefing, this was no mere garden variety blunder. There was an objection that could have been made under the law that had tremendous upside, no downside, and it should have been made. So on that basis, Jones respectfully requests that the court reverse and vacate the decision of the Federal District Court denying his petition for writ of habeas corpus and remand with instructions to either unconditionally or conditionally grant his petition for writ of habeas corpus. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And thank you as well for accepting this appointment. The court appreciates your service. And thanks as well to the attorney for the state. We will take the case under advisement.